Right, well, thank you very much. I'm rather overwhelmed at the number of people who have come to hear me, and I'm sort of uncomfortably reminded that I think I'm also responsible for health and safety in this outfit. So can I just point out the... and any arsonists, please give time to clear the room. Anyway, I'm delighted that I can be here and that I can talk to CUID, and I suspect one or two other people as well. As you may have realized, I'm not a professional lecturer, so I need a stimulus to put stuff down on paper and to speak to an audience. And I'm very grateful to CUID and in particular to Carl for forcing me to do this. I think I ought to begin with a couple of disclaimers. Firstly, I am not a development expert. I am not a development economist. I am not, in fact, an economist. I am not, in fact, an academic. So what you're going to get from me is something perhaps a little bit different. If it was written down on paper, there would not be a single footnote. And I have realized from my short experience of academic life that something without footnotes is really worth very little indeed. But what you will get from me is the impressions of a hands-on practitioner. For most of my working life, it is still going on, my working life, but for most of it, I was a professional diplomat. For just about half of that, I was either living in China or I was dealing with China from somewhere else like London. And for 10 of those years, I was actually living in China. So it's a kind of hands-on experience that you're going to get. I'll be talking on the basis of my own direct understanding of the situation in China. This is a development forum, but I will in fact be talking about development in a very broad sense, in a rather non-technical sense. What I will really be trying to describe is how China has developed, or how China has evolved, if you like, in a number of different aspects during the time in which I have known China. And so I'm going to establish a sort of baseline which conveniently coincides with the beginning of my own encounters with China, which was roughly 40 years ago. And then I'm going to follow three lines of development. The first is, in fact, economic development. We'll look a little bit at how China has developed economically and what it has achieved, what the challenges now are. I'll be looking at social development, how Chinese society has changed during that time. Obviously, it has changed hugely. And finally, I'll be talking a bit about politics and governance and the institutions of governance and how those have changed over the same period. So much of my journey is in fact coterminous, if that's the word, with the process of what is known as reform and opening. Reform and opening launched by Deng Xiaoping in December 1978. It's been going strong for 30 years, and the successes of reform and opening are being celebrated very actively in China, no doubt, as we speak. So I'll be talking, so what it amounts to, in part, is to look at reform and opening, particularly in its internal aspects. Obviously, it has external aspects as well. What has it achieved? And what are the problems and challenges that still lie ahead? But I'll be starting a little bit further back than the beginning of reform and opening, because I arrived in China a bit before that. This is a very personal take. And also because my very, very first encounters with China were arguably at a time when post-liberation China really hit rock bottom. I joined the Foreign Office on the 1st of September 1967. And just a few days before that, in fact on the 22nd of August 1967, the office of the British Chargé d'Affaires in Beijing, Peking as we then called it, was burnt to the ground by a mob of Red Guards. We won't go in detail into the origins of that particular event, but let me just say that at the time, the Chinese Foreign Ministry had been effectively taken over by an extreme left faction. They hijacked Chinese foreign policy, which was, for a short period, very xenophobic and pretty violent. This was compounded where Britain was concerned because of the fact of Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, there was a campaign of bombing that had been launched. That was being egged on by the left-wing press in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong government put in jail the journalists responsible, and the Peking government told us that if we didn't let them out of jail, there would be serious consequences. And those were the serious consequences. So in a sense, that was a low point in China's relationships with the world outside. It was a state act by a country which had been engulfed in mindless revolutionary fervor. And just a few weeks after that, I was called in and given the opportunity to study Chinese. And so I felt really slightly daring, saying, yes, I would do that, secretly believing that it was going to take me a couple of years to study my Chinese, and by then, surely, things would have calmed down in Peking. And indeed, they had. Although not in any sort of sense of development in any particular direction as we would understand it. And so let me just establish another personal starting point, which is my very first encounter with mainland China, because it remains very much in my mind as a picture of the state of the country at the time. The year was 1970. The Cultural Revolution had sort of calmed down a bit, but it was still emphatically going on. I was a young diplomat at Hong Kong University. I was called to Beijing to fill in a gap for a few weeks in the British office there. And so I went into China the only way you could go in then, which is by getting on a little train in Kowloon by the harbour. And the train would potter up through the new territories, and gradually everyone got off the train. And then you went into the restricted zone, and then you got to the border. And then those people left on the train had to pick up their suitcases and walk across a little bridge. And on the other side, there was one building, which was Shenzhen Railway Station. And so I walked across the bridge. It's a nice sunny day. And there was this little whitewashed station. All the way around it, there were paddy fields. There were a few people planting out paddy in the paddy fields. And the only sound I could hear was tinny music coming out of a loudspeaker a little way away. And just on the horizon, I could see a little village. And that kind of told me quite a lot about China in those days. Shenzhen now, as many of you will know, is a city of about 9 million people. The border between Hong Kong and Shenzhen is the busiest land border in the world. On the particular day that I went there, there was only one train a day that went to the border. There was no other way that you could get into China on that particular day, because almost all its international links had been cut off. And there were three of us who walked across the bridge into China. So on that particular day, believe it or not, three people entered China. And I was one of them. So you had this picture of China as a place that was poor, isolated, largely agrarian, largely rural, and revolutionary. And really, there was only a slow change during the 1970s. It was really a bit of a period of drift. The Cultural Revolution eventually blew itself out. Some sort of sensible administration returned with the help of the military. Some of the victims of the Cultural Revolution reappeared out of prison, out of detention. Some of them moved back into positions of leadership. Mao died in 1976, but his ideological legacy lingered on for a few more years. The economy stagnated. The only sort of positive thing, really, was that during the 1970s, China did move out into the outside world. It established a lot of links with countries with whom it had previously not had contacts, including the United States. It took up China's seat at the United Nations. So externally, China was emerging. Internally, China was rather drifting. And really, it awaited Deng Xiaoping's firm reassertion of authority in 1978-1979 before any real sense of direction emerged. And the story of the 30 years that followed is, in outline, pretty well known to all of us. Let's look first at the economy. And clearly, over that period, well, that period, if you like, is a period of stunning achievement. We have seen continuous progress, continued rates of economic growth, with only a little dip in the rate after the events of Tiananmen in 1989 and the immediate aftermath. It's the longest sustained period of high-speed development that any economy has ever achieved. The only one that came near is South Korea in a slightly earlier phase, but South Korea, of course, is a smaller and arguably more manageable economy. Between 1994 and the present, China has managed a rate of growth of just below 10%, an annual rate of growth, which is pretty phenomenal. And so China has turned itself over that time into a country which, in formal UN terms, is now a lower middle-income country. Hundreds of millions of people have been taken out of extreme poverty. A solid national infrastructure has been laid down. Railways, roads, provincial airports. The cities have been transformed. And of course, as we all know, China's manufacturing industry supplies global markets. And I'll come back to this, in the cities, a middle class, a professional middle class has emerged. And so really a great deal has been achieved. So what are the economic challenges now? And the answer is that there are plenty of them. And I'll just mention a few. Firstly, inequalities. Inequalities between the developed east of the country and the less developed west. Inequalities between the cities and the countryside. Inequalities even within the cities between the very rich, and there are very rich people, and the people at the other end, at the bottom of the heap. China is now a country which is more unequal than the United States. There are stubborn areas of extreme poverty that remain. Using Chinese criteria, it's about 40 million people. But if you look at the international poverty line, which is a sort of a higher level, there are still 500 million people in China which do not go above the international poverty line. So we now see images of China as an urban, rather glitzy country. In the countryside, there are still hundreds of millions who are better off than they were. But the aim of reaching a society which is called a Xiaokang society, a society where everyone is moderately well off, is still really a long way away. Now, the Chinese authorities have analyzed this. They recognize the dangers of inequality. And what we have seen over the last few years is a sort of rebalancing of economic policy. The watchword now is harmonious development, which means a lot of different things. But one of the things it means is that you don't go all out for headline growth. You care about the quality of growth. You care about how prosperity is spread among the different sections of the population. And we have seen a series of policies which are designed to shift resources towards the under-resourced areas of the economy. That means primarily rural areas, in particular rural health, rural education, and the first attempt to put into place some sort of social security system in the countryside. So policies are have been conceived and are being implemented to address these problems, but there is a long way to go. The second range of challenges relates to the effects of unrestrained growth on the environment. And those have really been pretty devastating. China has high levels of air pollution, water pollution, pollution of the land. Desertification is a problem. Deforestation is a problem. I lived in Peking for 8 years. It is up there among the 20 most polluted countries in the world by UN standards. 17 of them are in China. And you can tell it every time you take a bit of exercise. I would run around the park and come back gasping. Here too, there are efforts to create a better sense of balance, to have some sort of harmony between the effects of growth and what is happening to the environment. So greener growth is the watchword. Penalizing polluters is another big policy strand. So I think now there is a good understanding at the top of the whole system what is wrong and what the policy changes have to be. But as always in China, from the top down to the grassroots is a very long way, literally a very long way, very often. And so, so it's very hard to control the implementation of policy at the grassroots. The third thing I'd mention is the strain on resources, both at a national level and, in many cases, at an international level. Now, some of those strains have been reduced a bit as Chinese growth rates have moderated a bit. But we can remember from last year, from the year before that, the effect of overheating world markets in almost any commodity you name. Markets for steel, for aluminium, for minerals, for shipping, for various forms of energy. All these markets at the time were roaring away, largely because of the rate at which China was sucking in these various commodities. Those markets might have moderated a bit, but there are still problems to be faced inside the country. One big problem is the rate at which agricultural land is being gobbled up. Urban development is encroaching on it. It disappears under tarmac. And this has an effect on agricultural yields. There is a major problem of water in the north of the country. Low rainfall, groundwater being depleted, heavy strains on the environment. And so now there is a very, very ambitious plan which involves guiding water out of southern river systems through a series of canals and tipping it into northern river systems. And now, of course, China faces a series of new challenges caused by the global economic downturn. Now, Chinese banks have not been very directly affected by the banking crisis. They were insulated from it. They are very, very conservatively managed, and so they do not carry debt in the way that Western banks do. But the real problem for China, of course, has been its openness to the global trading system. And so growth in the last quarter of 2008 was down at 6.8%. That is significant. I mean, it sounds pretty good to all of us, but that is significant because it is generally accepted that growth of 7 to 8% is needed annually simply to absorb the surplus labor which is coming into the cities, in particular, of course, from the migrant population underemployed in the countryside. The demand for a whole range of export commodities has been very sharply reduced. Factories are closing. Labor is being shaken out. The figure for January has to be explained a bit, but exports in January went down by 17.5% compared with the year before. It's partly to do with when Chinese New Year falls, but even if you try and cancel that out, economists reckon it was perhaps 7% down, and that's a big drop over a year. It has been admitted recently by Chinese officials that something like 20 million migrant workers who have been working in the cities have lost their jobs and they're heading back to their villages with no job to go to. There are also fears for graduate employment. This year's graduates are going to hit the market at a time when the market simply will not be able to absorb them. And Premier Wen Jiabao has said that China's biggest challenge is to deal with these two aspects of unemployment. There are fears, very explicitly voiced, fears of social instability and unrest. After all, we're seeing it in a significant way in a number of Western countries which arguably have more in the way of safety valves than Chinese society has. And so we're seeing action taken in China, just as in the West, to boost domestic investment, to pump money into the economy, to promote domestic consumption, and to support exporters. But it's going to be a very difficult thing to bring off. Wen Jiabao, when he was in Europe recently, he said he thought 8% growth was still possible this year, but it would be very difficult. And my guess is that it's impossible. When you look at the extent of China's vulnerability in terms of its export orientation, and if you see what's going to happen to the economy in the rest of the world. So there's no shortage of really testing economic challenges for China. The rebalancing of the economy, to which I referred, has got to go further. So away from manufacturing for export markets towards stimulating domestic consumption. How to deal with poverty is still a very major preoccupation, and it is being tackled very, very energetically. And I should say in passing that international aid organizations and national aid organizations like DFID, they like working in China in the sense that they can interact with a government machine which is highly effective and highly efficient. So that's economic development. Let's now turn to social development. Now here we're talking about a slightly different quality, something which is less easily defined, less easily measured. There is not a sort of linear path of social development the way there is in terms of economic development. So it's all slightly more impressionistic. But my starting point again is somewhere back in 1967, somewhere like that, the height of the Cultural Revolution, when, of course, what you had in China was a very highly politicized, a very highly radicalized society. Ideology ruled. What mattered were your political origins and your political credentials. There was an interesting antithesis at the time between red and expert. Red meant that you were politically impeccable. Expert meant that you were actually, you actually got some knowledge about something. And red was infinitely better than expert. Expert was in fact rather suspect by virtue of not being red. And so this led to some quite scary times during the Cultural Revolution when, for example, hospitals were put in the hands of people who were emphatically red rather than expert. So that was kind of a starting point. It was a society which was very equal in one sense. Cash incomes for everyone were pretty low. The party, the Communist Party, was ever present in daily life. Not only did it dominate all your activities, endless rallies, meetings, study sessions, but the party also decided on all the major decisions of your own personal life. Where to live, what house to live in, where to study, what job to take, when to have your baby. It was the party that decided all of those things. And so that's the starting point. And I'm going to look at just three aspects of how things have changed. Firstly, changes in what I will rather daringly call class structure, and in particular, the emergence of something looking remarkably like a middle class. Secondly, the replacement of ideology by other value systems. And finally, the emergence of civil society and its institutions. Now, of course, it's not very politically correct to analyze society in terms of class. Class has kind of disappeared from China. But something remarkably similar to an urban professional middle class has emerged. And there are a number of interlinked reasons for that. A widening of income disparities. People have more disposable income. The growth of the business sector. So managerial classes have emerged, both in domestic companies and in multinational and foreign invested companies. The development of the professions, new professions, the law, accountancy, management consulting, a managerial class in the public sector emerging. The emergence of a consumer mentality and also of a range of consumer and service industries to service that new consumerism. And so what has emerged from that is a professional middle class, very largely urban, with a lifestyle which is very comparable to the lifestyle of their Western equivalents, and with very much the same concerns. I remember that very, very vividly. I was, about 5 years ago, I was holding a dinner in Chongqing, city in southwest China, not sort of cutting edge, but sort of developing pretty rapidly. And I'd invited a lot of local business people to talk to me so that I got some feel for the place. And so very dutifully, I asked them all sorts of questions about the business climate and about business opportunities and so on. And that was all quite hard work. It was all happening in Chinese. And so towards the end of the evening, I sort of sat back a bit and they started talking more among themselves. And I suddenly realized as I was listening that they were really talking about the same things that, where I come from in North London, people talk about at dinner parties. So they were talking about the new housing developments going around Chongqing, where was a good place to live, where the prices were good, where the amenities were good. They were talking about which school to send their children to, which school was less expensive than others. They're all technically free, but which school was less expensive than others, which school had the best rates of university entrance, where to go for their next foreign holiday. And I thought, my word, we're all middle class now. But what kind of follows from this also is that you see the emergence of a group which are better educated, have a wider horizon, they are more articulate, and they're better at defending their own interests. And that's quite interesting. And so in the middle class, or through the middle class, you're beginning to see the emergence of pressure groups. You're beginning to see the emergence of a mentality which can only be described as a NIMBY mentality, not in my backyard. And that was brought home to me just a couple of years ago, when there were plans in Shanghai to extend the maglev train. There's this wonderful train, it works on magnetic levitation, and it absolutely whisks people in from the airport to a station which is actually in the middle of nowhere. It's the largest exploitation of this technology in the world. It's very impressive, but it doesn't actually lead you where you want to go. And so there are now plans to extend the line. And this ran into a very solid wave of middle-class opposition. And these were people who had bought their apartments in brand new apartment blocks along the route of the extended train line. And they were adamant that the maglev train was not going to go through their backyard, partly out of some sort of undefined sort of health concerns, and partly simply because they feared that it would affect the value of their property. Sound familiar? And that was kind of new. And it was, you know, the authorities have a certain amount of experience now at dealing with rather inarticulate working class or rural demonstrators. And there are well-known sort of tactics for dealing with them. And basically, you pay them off if you can, you put the leaders in jail if you have to, and you sort of get all the rest to go home. But it wouldn't work with these middle-class protesters. And that was quite sort of a new sort of turn in social relations, I thought, in China. Now, the second change I mentioned was, I think it will be summed up as the death of ideology. Ideology is dead. No one believes in it. No one even pretends to believe in it. And it's been replaced, it's tempting to say it's been replaced by shopping. consumerism sort of makes the world go round. And so party membership nowadays is not about believing anything. It's really about, and I suspect there are some members of the Chinese Communist Party in this audience, but I will plow on regardless. It's not about believing anything. It's about belonging. It's about networking. And it's about getting ahead. Of course, it remains, for those reasons, it remains very attractive. The party has about 73 million members, and membership is going up, which is more than could be said out of any Western political party I can think of. And so the party secures the allegiance of its members by providing those sorts of benefits, and it secures the support, or at least the acquiescence, of the general public by delivering the goods. And delivering the goods means economic growth, jobs, and rising living standards. But the flip side of that is that the party worries that if it can't deliver the goods, then there's no basis for it to have credibility, and there is no basis for it to have popular support. And so the party doesn't really expect belief, but nonetheless it worries about the absence of belief. And it worries that there's a sort of hollowness about society underneath the consumerist surface. And it worries that other people feel that as well. And the party notes, for example, that according to official Chinese statistics, religious practice is going up. Whichever religion you look at, Buddhism, Taoism, two brands of Christianity, Islam, in each case, the number of adherents is going up. And they have kind of ambivalent feelings about that. After all, the Communist Party is officially atheist, but on the other hand, religious believers, with a few obvious exceptions, tend to be fairly law-abiding people. So, you know, they worry, is it actually a factor for stability if people go to church, or if people go to the local Buddhist temple? But really, what it would prefer to do would be to substitute other secular value systems. And that's what you see the authorities trying to do. The prime one, of course, is what could be called patriotism, what very often looks more like nationalism. And so in schools, in universities, there is something called patriotic education, which teaches you about China's history and teaches you that China was a great country and is on the process to becoming a great country over again, a country to be reckoned with. And you can see that, you can see all sorts of manifestations of that, sometimes rather rather sweet. At the Olympics, for example, you know, the forest of red flags. Other times taking a slightly more ugly form, like, for example, outside various Japanese official government buildings, which from time to time are demonstrated outside. There's an attempt to inculcate a pride in history and in some of the great figures of China's past. So that some figures who not so long ago were regarded as hopelessly feudal, like Confucius or the first Chinese emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi, now there's a little sort of mini cult of these people to try and sort of build them up as admirable people in China's history. And then more generally, there is the attempt to inculcate civilization or civilized behavior. And the word for civilization, Wenming, is sort of used in a lot of contexts, ranging from the rather grandiose to the rather less grandiose. So to be, you see posters saying, we will be a civilized borough in Beijing. And you discover that this is about not dropping litter, it's about queuing for buses, and it's about not spitting on the pavement. So that is also civilization. So there's an attempt to inculcate civic virtues as well. Now, the third phenomenon I'd like to mention is the slow emergence of civil society and its institutions. Now, it's slow, really, because the party is nervous and suspicious about any form of grouping which was not formed on its initiative and subject to its control. I think it could be said that in China, relatively speaking, the sense of community has tended to be rather limited in terms of loyalty to the family or to the clan or to the village or to the secret society. But the idea of community spirit as a broader concept is relatively less well developed. And I think in modern China, this has been hampered also by what I have said about the party's ambition to monopolize any form of institutional organization. So all social activity, traditionally, has come under mass organizations run by the party. So there is a mass organization for children, Little Red Soldiers. There's a mass organization for youth. There's a mass organization for women. There's a mass organization for peasants. So in each case, there is one organization, it covers everyone, and it's under the leadership of the party. All religious organizations report to a department of the party. The trade unions are, of course, a party organization. All non-governmental organizations have to find a government department which is prepared to sponsor them. So you cannot set up a pressure group or an organization until you have found somewhere a sort of godfather, a godmother, I think they're called, who will look after you. And so the result is that the sort of multiplicity of civil organizations that we take for granted in Western society are not so present, nothing like so present, in China. They exist really only under heavy supervision. What we're seeing, quite interestingly, is some exceptions beginning to emerge. And you see areas where the authority kind of weigh up the risks. And they think, well, it would be useful if people could be mobilized to be a bit more active in this area. And so perhaps it's worth taking a risk and allowing them to set up an organization. So you can think of environmental organizations, for example, where I think the judgment has been made, if you activate people to plant trees, to support the greening of the landscape and so on, that's worth the risk. There are organizations emerging in health and in social security, areas dealing with drug addiction, dealing with HIV patients, that sort of thing. One agent of community that has emerged very rapidly in the West is, of course, all the various electronic means of communicating. Chat rooms, blogging, Facebook, and so on. And this has taken off in a huge way in China. Partly, I think, because it is something which is pretty difficult to control. But it has to be said that given the difficulty of doing so, the Chinese authorities are being remarkably successful. After all, resources are no great problem. And anecdotally, we're told that tens of thousands of people are employed full-time monitoring internet traffic. And there is very, very sophisticated technology at work blocking out external websites, monitoring internet conversations, SMS conversations through word recognition technology. So really quite a remarkable amount can be done. And so these areas boom, but they boom in the knowledge on the part of the users that chat rooms are manipulated. You never know whether the person who makes an entry in a chat room is a private individual or working on behalf of the party. Blogs are read, blogs are censored, internet and SMS traffic is intercepted. So society, an overall a picture of rapid and tumultuous social change. The party has stood back a long way from where it once was in terms of controlling people's lives. But the party still has the ambition and the means to control where it matters. And this leads me finally to the area of politics and governance. And here I would say that there's a certain I would see a very stark contrast between an economy which is developing and evolving and diversifying very rapidly, a society where exactly the same thing is happening, and a party and a system of governance which is pretty stagnant. And I used to feel that very strongly when I was in Beijing. And over the years, I have been able to go to some big state events at the Great Hall of the People. And I would go over the years, and somehow nothing seemed to change very much. There was a moment when finally everyone arrived in a suit and tie. But the back, you had these sort of frozen red flags. The backdrop didn't change. You know, the behavior of the people on the platform didn't change very much. And I would come out thinking, you know, outside, the world has changed so much. Inside, the Party Congress looks remarkably the way that it did 20 years earlier. Of course, the party remains the only show in town. It does continue to attract very high caliber people, and the people at the top of the party, at the top of government, are people who are arguably the most talented people in the country. And out of 1.3 billion people, that means you have some very smart people at the top. The current political leaders are very capable managers, or they would not be there. And it is true also that the party has shown quite remarkable resilience in many ways. After all, it picked itself up after 1989 and Tiananmen. After all, it reinvented itself while other communist parties around the world were biting the dust. And the party now really puts its money on efficient management. So you see a very heavy investment in management training at every level. Gleaming new management colleges, parties dispatched overseas to study management, at some of the most prestigious universities in the world, including Cambridge. Partly this training is a matter of getting cadres on message, making sure they understand policy, and partly it is general management training. The party has also realized that government has to be more transparent and more responsive, and at least at local government, huge efforts are being made to do that. And so you see around the country experiments and trials, how local government is opening up, how are we doing, answer our questionnaire, rank our services, and so on. You know, a real attempt to demonstrate that they are listening to people, they're responding to people. So, and this is having some effect, I think. There is some change, but it's still pretty patchy. And at the local level, very often local government remains pretty much as it always was. And there are problems, and no one will pretend there aren't, of maladministration and of corruption throughout the country. So superficially, you're seeing change, you're seeing updating, you're seeing a new sort of friendly face. But underneath, I think the party has not greatly changed. And that is really that the party can't tolerate challenge or competition. It can't tolerate any parallel institution. It can't really tolerate any challenge from an individual. The party remains above the law. The legislature is guided by the party. The courts are guided by the party. The party will not permit scrutiny by the media, so to be on the safe side, it controls the media and tells them what they can write about. And it fears, above all, instability and chaos. In China, the word chaos has a great sort of historical resonance. From time to time, there has been chaos, order has broken down, dynasties fall. People do talk about political reform, but you have to understand just how narrowly this term is actually defined. There are experiments in democracy. They tend to happen within the party where they're more easily controlled, and they tend to be pretty minimal. Nowadays, if you hold an election at a lower level in the party, you might have one or two more candidates than there are places to fill through the election. There have, for some time, been experiments at the very lowest level in the countryside, in experiments in direct elections. But they've been going on for a very long time. They're very highly controlled. And clearly, there is no consensus at the top that these experiments should be extended or expanded or raised to a higher level. And so, really, on this aspect of development, China's leaders remain pretty timid, pretty uncertain. I think there is quite a widespread recognition in the party, and people will talk to you about it, you know, late at night after dinner in Beijing, that the present situation is actually untenable in the long term. And that is something which is discussed by academics, by intellectuals, by people in think tanks, by people even in such bastions as the Central Party School. But the feeling also is, I think, that the current generation of leaders do not have the confidence to make a move. But there are some sort of homegrown suggestions for change, and I think it's quite instructive to see at present how those are handled. So I'm going to read you a little quote. The Chinese people, who have endured human rights disasters and uncountable struggles, now include many who see clearly that freedom, equality, and human rights are universal values of humankind, and that democracy and constitutional government are the fundamental framework for protecting these values. By departing from these values, this is still quoting, the Chinese government's approach to, quote, modernization has proven disastrous. It has stripped people of their rights, destroyed their dignity, and corrupted normal human intercourse. So we ask, where is China headed in the 21st century? Will it continue with, quotes, modernization under authoritarian rule? Or will it embrace universal human values, join the mainstream of civilized nations, and build a democratic system? Now, the authors of that quote are all Chinese. It's an extract from something which is called Charter 08. It was promulgated, it was circulated on the internet on the 10th of December 2008, which is Human Rights Day, which was the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which China subscribes. That charter is still doing the rounds in China. It is, of course, systematically removed from the internet. References to it are expunged from the internet. But by now, several thousand people, not a large number, but several thousand people, have been prepared to put their names to it. One of the authors has been arrested and is reportedly going to face trial. Many of the signatories have been called in by the police, harassed, and pressure has been put on them to recant. That, I think, illustrates where, at the moment, China's development in this sort of area has reached. Now, we could ask, I think, what position China's universities are taking on this. Universities, which we treasure as a forum for free debate and the free exchange of ideas. So let me read you one more quote just before I finish. This is an emergency notice which was issued to students at Peking University Law School, Peking University, with Tsinghua, the Oxbridge of China. on 16 January 2009. And this has 4 points. It doesn't actually refer to Charter 08, but you have to guess that that's what it's really about. But this was issued just before the students left for their Chinese New Year holidays. Point one, students should be clear about what is really at stake here. Anti-party, anti-socialist activity. Point two, as party members, students should affirm the party's leadership and firmly boycott and stay away from these actions and maintain a clear state of mind. They should not blindly conform and follow the actions of the crowd, nor should they distribute harmful information through various news media and other communication channels. Point three, students should take the initiative to actively keep an eye on their surrounding co-workers and classmates, place their academic and individual growth as their priorities, and uphold the country's harmony and stability. Point four, if students discover any relevant questionable situations, they should immediately report to the party organisation. And the notice ends, have a great vacation. So, to sum up, I would say that China's development over the past 40 years has been hugely impressive in many senses, incomplete in others. Economically, we've seen that a great deal has been achieved, but the costs incurred along the way are now better understood, and the rebalancing of the development model is underway. So there are huge challenges ahead, and China is not immune from the current economic crisis. Socially, I think it says a huge amount about the resilience of Chinese society that within one generation, the people in it have moved from the Cultural Revolution to where China is today. There are tensions, there are doubts, there is questioning, but that could scarcely be otherwise. And that is no less true of societies like our own, which have evolved far more stably and in a far more gradual way. The biggest questions for me relate to the arrested development of civic society and the phenomena connected with single-party control. Over the past, this has permitted a tremendous sense of focus, a tremendous sense of mobilization. But I see tensions between, on the one hand, a society and an economy in flux, and on the other hand, a political system which is essentially static, as tensions that can only grow. I don't think it follows from that that we'll see explosion or breakdown. I don't belong to the sort of apocalyptic class of China watchers. But I do feel that if there is not, over time, some evolution, some flexibility, China will find it impossible to develop into a stable and healthy modern society. Thank you very much.